Good morning. Got three cases to hear this morning. Counsel, we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, authority cited in your briefs. We've looked at least portions of the record. And so in your limited time, feel free to get straight to the heart of your argument and pay attention to the traffic lights. And when the red line shows, it's time to stop. Of course, if you're answering a question from the court, you can finish up your answer. So we'll start with United States versus Owen. Ms. Strickland.
Good morning. May it please the court. The funds in Richard Owen's jail account were seized without any notice to him and with no opportunity to object. This was error no matter what.
They were transferred to the registry, and then he was given an opportunity to argue about why he was entitled to those funds. They shouldn't be used to pay counsel, and that the court considered all that before it made a final decision.
Your Honor, the funds were seized before Mr. Owen had an opportunity to object. And that is where the error
weren't
occurred.
Paid to counsel. They could have been, he was given an opportunity to be heard right before there was any payment of those funds to counsel. Isn't that right? They could have been returned to him.
Your Honor, he did not receive a meaningful opportunity to be heard, and due process requires both. So initially, Your Honor, the error occurred, and whether we're proceeding under the CJA statute, Section 3006A.
Well, that's what I understood you to raise in your brief, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I know the court has submitted some questions for the parties, and I'm going to try to address all of those questions. And that first question is whether a due process issue is before the court. And it is, because in the brief, while it certainly would have been better practice for me to say due process, I did say notice and an opportunity to object, and that is that is the fundamental tenet of due process. That is how the claim is framed, and that's what's argued consistently.
But counsel, wasn't that in the context of Bercy and how there wasn't that quote-unquote appropriate inquiry that Bercy promises before there's a disbursement of the money to the CJA fund?
Well, Your Honor, Bercy itself is a due process case. The parties there raised a due process issue, and the court in Bercy looked at the CJA statute and interpreted it in a way that complied with due process.
Well, what they said is you're entitled to an appropriate inquiry before an order is given requiring that the money be paid to the CJA fund, right?
Right.
Your Honor, the final paragraph in Bercy at page 1239 says that the court erred in summarily committing the bond deposit to the United States.
Right, and what it said is there was error because there wasn't an appropriate inquiry, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. There was not an appropriate inquiry.
And your argument, as I understood it, both in the blue and the gray brief, was that here there was not an appropriate inquiry because there wasn't a hearing and notice before the money was transferred from the jail to the registry of the court, right?
The appropriate inquiry should have occurred before the funds were seized. Once Mr. Owen was dispossessed of the property, that's where the error occurred.
And you may or may not be right regarding that, but that really doesn't put anybody on notice, which is really what this is all about, the government on notice and a full briefing of Matthew's due process, which is an extended three-step process about what processes do in a given procedural circumstance, right?
Right, but the court does not have to get to the Matthews analysis because this court, as the Fifth Circuit, has already held in Bercy that this appropriate inquiry, which Bercy explicitly says is at least notice and opportunity to be heard, is required. And here there was no notice before the seizure.
So let me ask you this. If we find that under Bercy, that there was appropriate inquiry under Bercy, then we could rule against you based on the argument that was raised in front of us without getting to Matthews and all that other stuff.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I believe the due process claim is raised because essentially notice and opportunity to be heard. Again, I should have said due process, but that is essentially shorthand for due process. The Supreme Court has consistently held that the fundamental tenet of due process is notice and opportunity to be heard. That goes all the way back to the founding of this country, but in Orris v. Ordon, 234 U.S. 385 back in 1914, the court said that again in the Matthews case and has said repeatedly in its case law about the due process clause that due process is notice and an opportunity to object. So while I should have framed it better, I believe the issue is raised, and this court can get to it if they believe that Bercy needs to be reevaluated in some way. But Bercy is a decision from this court that says that it is error for the court to take these funds without any notice or opportunity to object. So the court's inquiry can end there at Bercy. The funds were seized without notice and an opportunity to object. But if this court does continue to the...
I'm reading from page 28 of your blue brief, where it states, quote, this court's decision in Bercy, I'm giving shorthand, prohibits the district court from summarily disbursing funds of the Treasury under section 3006AF and requires the district court to first make an appropriate inquiry. ... And then the next sentence is, here, the district court made no attempt to comply with the section and Bercy, so that's the error. The court provided no notice and made no inquiry as to the availability of funds before entering its order, right?
That's what the brief says, Your Honor.
Right. I mean, how is that not a failure to comply with statutory requirements as interpreted by Bercy rather than a constitutional due process claim, which are different?
Because Bercy is a due process case that says due process is required for the statute
The statute requires due process, is what it's saying.
Yes.
It's not saying that because of the Fifth Amendment.
The statute requires due process, yes, right. And that's Fifth Amendment due process. I don't think the court in Bercy was drawing a distinction between, because the parties had argued due process and the statute, and Bercy is essentially the court reading the statute in a way that complies with due process, because they go back up, the statute that allows the funds to be directed to the Treasury is Section F, and in Bercy, the court went up to Section C, I believe, and said that the appropriate inquiry has to be read into Section F. That's because otherwise it would not comply with due process. And so the Bercy court held that...
What the court did what courts do, which is read it in para materia, all three sections, subsection B, subsection C, and subsection F of the CJA statute. And reading it together, it determined that where the funds were dedicated, they needed to go through the appropriate inquiry that was discussed in the statute, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So, again, I'm piggybacking off of Judge Bill Pryor's questions, but how is this not a statutory claim as opposed to a failure to comply with minimum requirements of the Fifth Amendment?
Your Honor, I believe it's a due process claim for the reasons that I've stated, that I argued notice and opportunity to object. So I'm going to turn to the due process issue.
Let me just ask you one question before you do that. In the joint motion for continuance that the parties filed, the motion said that the issues raised... significant issues and cites case law that was not discussed in the party's original briefing. How is that not an abandonment of the Fifth Amendment argument?
Your Honor, I did not discuss Matthews in the briefing, and the cases that appear in the court's order are not discussed in the briefing. So that's correct. But as far as abandoning the issue, you know, I couldn't honestly say that I had cited Matthews in the case, but that's because citing Matthews, I believe, is unnecessary because Bercy controls.
And I'm sorry, one last question before you get to the merits, and I know you want to get there. The heading on page 7 of the gray brief states, District Court failed to follow proper procedure before seizing funds pursuant to 18 U.S.C. 3660AF. I mean, isn't that talking about the proper procedure under the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, that heading does talk about the proper procedure under the statute. But as far as the due process claim itself, the Supreme Court has consistently held, and they said so in, this is in the 28J letter submitted to the court in Zimmerman v. Birch, 494 U.S. 113, that the Supreme Court has usually held that the Constitution requires some kind of hearing before the seizure, and where pre-deprivation safeguards would be of use in preventing an erroneous deprivation, then a hearing must be provided.
Okay, Ms. Strickland, let's assume just for the sake of argument, okay, going forward for a moment, that there wasn't a Fifth Amendment argument raised, okay, that we don't think there was, and that the argument is a statutory argument. And let's even assume that that the inquiry should have occurred before the seizure, okay? Why isn't, though, any error in any statutory error harmless, given that the district court went ahead and considered the evidence and arguments that your client made before those funds were paid to the AO?
Well, I have several answers to that, Your Honor, but the most direct answer is that we never have any sort of finding on what the CJA bill was. We don't know how much the representation cost, and the statute specifically allows the court to direct funds to the Treasury only for the amount that is already due. So we have to have some kind of calculation of what is actually due, and the court merely notes that it has an interim voucher. It does not say how much that voucher is. It does not say if the court is going to approve of that amount of the voucher, and we all know that vouchers sometimes get changed as they go through the court. So here we have no finding about how much Mr. Worthington's representation costs. So you can't affirm on harmless error because that has to be part of the appropriate inquiry under the statute. And, Your Honor,
how does that run into the jurisdictional problem, though? Because we've said that we don't have jurisdiction to review these orders unrelated to the outcomes of a case. But the only exception being a very narrow one for if the procedure is followed. The argument you're making doesn't seem to be procedural. I mean, it seems to be more substantive. In other words, the order didn't include X or Y, but there was still the procedure of an appropriate inquiry was still done, was it not?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe an appropriate inquiry was done, and that was just directly in response to the harmlessness question. I do believe that because this court cannot review the substance of the order, then it doesn't get to that question, that once there was no notice and the funds were seized and there was error under Bercy, then that's where the inquiry ends and the orders have to be vacated. Thank you.
Okay. You save 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Davids?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Justin Davids, and I'm an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Georgia, and I represent the appellee, the United States of America. Your Honors, to begin with the CJA issue, I'd like to point out first an overarching fact of the situation, which is when we refer to the government in this particular situation, we are talking about the judicial branch. It's the judicial branch that administers the CJA fund. In this case, the transfer of money was done by the judicial branch. The inquiry is done by the judicial branch, and the ultimate disbursement of the money to reimburse the CJA fund is done by the judiciary. The government, in the form of the executive branch, is not a part of this. If we look at Griggs, it talks about how this is an administrative function of the court, and it doesn't require an adversarial hearing, and that's because the government isn't a part of it. The government does not need to be notified that the court is going to exercise its authority under 3006 AF. And so I raise that just because that I think that informs the analysis throughout on the questions that were raised by the court, particularly the last set of questions about what remedies might be involved. Because I think when we get to that point, the question is going to be, does the court have the authority to make the court pay some sort of damages as a result?
Yeah, it seems to me that when we've said this is administrative, that we're saying that in the context of, well, what fees and expenses are allowable, and the computation and all of that's all administrative,
right?
But that's different from, it seems to me, a seizure of funds from the defendant and whether the defendant's been given notice and an opportunity to be heard. That doesn't strike me as administrative. You agree with that?
Your Honor, I think the hearing itself is still administrative. Now, I think that we read Bercy that it still carves out that section, that part, the procedural part, is still reviewable under 1291. And so I don't disagree with that. But I would say that the entire procedure involving the appropriate inquiry and ultimately determining whether funds are available is all part of one administrative hearing. And so if we look to has Owen raised a due process violation here? When I read the original briefing, it seems to me that Owen's main point is that he believes the court erred in finding that these funds were not Social Security disability payments that were exempted under the anti-attachment statute.
No, it's a little more than that. I mean, you heard the part that I read. The argument that one of the arguments they're making, I think that might be one of them ultimately too, but one of the arguments they seem to be making is that the funds were seized without notice first from the jail to account to the court registry, and that their client was entitled to at least notice that was going to happen and some opportunity to object before that happened, right?
And that is in the brief. I read that more as a piling on, though, to the district court and its decision ultimately.
Well, whether it's an afterthought or not, it's still a preserved argument.
Sure. And my response then is, even if that were preserved, or even if that were raised here, I don't know that was actually preserved in the district court. Again, in the district court, there were no complaints that he had not received notice. It was always, you know, once the court issued the order transferring the money out of his account, he raised objections based on the fact that these were exempted.
I think that's a fair point, but let's give me a hypothetical for a second. What if the facts were like those in Bercy, where the court just heard there was some money in there and said it's being applied strictly to CJA? There would have been no opportunity to object under that circumstance, would there? Do you have to file a reconsideration motion or rehearing to preserve it for appeal? I don't know any doctrine that says that.
I think you could, though. I mean, I think that you could still file an objection to it, and I think you could still challenge it. But I also think that because when we're talking about...
Well, that's separate from whether you require to in order to preserve an argument for appellate review, which is my question.
Sure. I think that in the circumstances of this case, Owen had multiple chances over the course of the case to raise concerns that he wasn't receiving appropriate procedure, and he never discussed that at all. It was always, this money is exempt under the anti-attachment statute. And so if it follows that this wasn't raised below, then plain error analysis would apply. But if it was preserved below, the government's position is that it's de novo review, but subject to harmless error analysis.
And what then? It's subject to harmless error analysis. Was there a harmless error?
Here?
Yes.
Was
there an error any error was harmless?
I don't think that there was error in this case, if we're looking at Matthews. And so,
well, let's assume we're not talking about Matthews. Let's just look at the statute for a moment.
Well, the problem with the statute is that it doesn't. The statute itself doesn't really lay out what the appropriate
inquiry,
what appropriate inquiry,
or when it occurs.
Well, I mean, B initially occurs at when we're considering appointing an attorney to begin with, right? As Bercy read all of these together, then the procedure, whatever that procedure is under B, is imported into subsection F, mm-hmm. right? And so, but cases have held that regarding B, that, for example, that it depends on the circumstances of the case, but in many cases, the appropriate procedure in determining the appropriate inquiry under B can be satisfied simply by the court evaluating the standard financial affidavit that the defendant completes prior to the court determining whether to appoint CJA counsel. So I think we really are getting into the circumstances of a particular case, even under B, and whether notice is required. And notice what, and in Bercy, they did say that notice was required. And counsel pointed out the last part of Bercy, but I think it's interesting to point out one part of that sentence that wasn't read. The court that said, thus, we hold only that the district court erred in summarily appropriating the cash deposit to the Treasury in the circumstances of this case. Bercy itself is limiting itself to the circumstances of that particular case. And the circumstances of Bercy involved a third party depositing bond money with the court. And so that's a little bit different situation than what we have here. Arguably, in Bercy, the money was already within the control of the court. And so some of the circumstances that apply in Owen's case do not necessarily apply in Bercy. Those circumstances include that despite the fact that he was a mid-60s to late-60s-year-old man when he was found in California, the district court judge there detained him as a flight risk. This was based on the charges and the allegations in the case, which included bank fraud, money laundering, and identity theft. It involved $500,000 that was taken from his employer's trust account and was never found by the government. This caused great concern. Once he was transferred to the Southern District of Georgia, he filed an objection to that detention hearing, and a second, separate federal judge, de novo, reviewed that and also held him. And so what we have here is a situation where the court could have some legitimate concerns that if...
Would you agree with me that the inquiry should have occurred, and noticing the inquiry should have occurred before the funds were transferred to the court?
I agree an inquiry should occur. I don't agree in the facts of this case that notice should have been given. I think that the court, in order to protect the funds and make sure that in this case that the defendant didn't somehow disperse these funds prior to the court making its decision, could gain some control of those. But even if that were error,
yes,
I think harmless error still applies in this case.
And why would it be harmless? Let's say it is error.
It's harmless because Owen was ultimately given several opportunities to present his arguments, to provide evidence. The court, it wasn't even just one hearing, Your Honor. The initial order occurred not long before trial was about to start. And at that time, I believe Mr. Owen was represented. His attorney filed the objections based on the anti-attachment statute. And then this was discussed at several hearings along the way. Mr. Owen asked the court how the court would like him to present evidence of this court of his claim, and the court explained to it. He was allowed to file additional objections and provide affidavits. When the court indicated that it didn't really find the affidavits too compelling on their own, he was allowed to present more evidence in the form of bank records. And it was after that that the court finally rendered its decision. I know that the defendant doesn't believe that the ultimate conclusion by the court was correct. He doesn't believe that the court is correct in finding that that he did not prove that these were Social Security funds, but that conclusion.
We have jurisdiction to determine that.
No, Your Honor. I think that's the part of Griggs that we get into, is that the court doesn't have the jurisdiction.
How different would this case or these questions be if this case arose out of Miami, where pretrial defendants are serving in the federal detention center, which is next door to the federal and attached to the federal courthouse, as opposed to at a local county jail that someone's brought back and forth to?
Your Honor, I have no experience with Miami, other than knowing it's a lovely city.
Let me put it this way. Assume that he was in a federal facility and the money was in a federal facility, mm-hmm. as opposed to in a local county jail.
Mm-hmm.
I was just giving color to the to those questions.
Sure. And I appreciate that, Judge. I think for the purposes of whether we're talking about notice, I don't think it really matters.
Why?
I think what we're talking about is the transfer of the money.
Right, from a county facility to the registry. But if it was already in the federal facility, there'd be no need to transfer it. And all that would say is, I have an intention of doing it, just like the trial court did here, and tell me why I can't, file an objection, and go. Doesn't that make a huge difference? And why should it make a difference?
I think that, though, that the real concern, though, is if the court gives notice before that, and honestly, Judge, I don't know the intricacies of how the federal detention center monitors and.
Well, let me ask it this way: if your point in Bercy was the money was arguably already in federal custody, right?
Sure.
Because it was bond money deposited with the court.
Sure.
Wouldn't it be the same thing if he was in a federal jail?
No, because I think that even if he's in the federal jail, he still has some control over those funds. Whereas in Bercy, that defendant didn't have any control over those.
The court isn't holding it in trust, the deposit on the bond?
It was deposited by a third party on his behalf. It was never his money to begin with.
Right, but the court's holding it in trust for someone else. It's not the court's money to use however it wants. It's in a trust account, right?
Sure. But the concern is here, given who Mr. Owen is, that he might direct that money to out of the account. I don't see how in Bercy the defendant could affect where that money went.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Strickland.
Your Honor, I believe what Judge Luck was just asking is very relevant here, because it goes to my point that Bercy is really on point, and it's just because these funds were held in a county jail that Judge Bowen ended up doing this two-step process.
Here's what Bercy says, at least one sentence. Quote, at the very least, this is on page 1238 of the opinion, at the very least, such an inquiry should have involved notice to Bercy of the anticipated disbursement and an opportunity for him and or his sponsor to prompt the motion to intervene. The notice needs to be before the disbursement, not the sequestration. That's what the word I'll use for what happened here. That's the minimum that they said is required. How did this not comply exactly with Bercy?
Your Honor, because Bercy was speaking about those facts before it, and that's what the statute actually allows is for the court to direct the funds.
You just started by saying Bercy's directly on point. I kind of agree.
I'm sorry?
You started off, but your first words here were,
yes,
Judge Luck has a good point, which is nice to say, and that Bercy's on point, and I tend to agree with you, but Bercy says that that's the minimum that's required. Why is that not the minimum that's required here? And relatedly, why does the fact that the money's in a county jail matter at all if the county was in an FDC account?
Because Bercy was not considering this two-step process that the court used here, because that's not what the statute allows. The court here sees the money, and that's when the appropriate inquiry should have occurred. It's just that in Bercy,
I apologize, but the two-step process is only a reflection of the fact that this is in southern Georgia, and where there isn't a federal facility, I assume, right next door, where you can bring people back and forth, versus a larger place where there's a federal detention center right next door and people are housed federally. How does that make difference for as a matter of statutory notice and opportunity to
The seizure was not necessary to accomplish this. The statute allows the court to direct the funds be paid. So the court could have provided notice to Mr. Owen, allowed him an opportunity to object, and then entered an order directing the funds to the that the funds be committed to the Treasury at that point.
But in the meantime, Mr. Owen could have withdrew all the money from the account, right?
Your Honor, I believe that there's not a sufficient government interest, and this is where we get to the due process issue, that there's not a sufficient government interest to allow this pre-notice seizure. The general rule in due process law is that notice is required before the seizure, and it requires exigent circumstances for the government to seize property without any notice. And here, we don't have exigent circumstances because we don't have a great government interest in recouping these CJA funds. This is not a situation where the CJA fund rises and falls with defendant contributions. It's not a situation where others are not going to get representation because Mr. Owen has not paid his $6,500 towards the representation. So the government has an extremely limited interest in this case, and for that reason, Mr. Owen was required to have a pre-seizure, predisposition, opportunity to object, and notice of that. So, in sum, Your Honors, I believe there was error under Bercy. The appropriate inquiry required was required before it was seized, and that was error. The court's analysis stops there because we can't look at the substance of the order, and because that was error, those orders regarding Mr. Owen's funds must be vacated.
Thank you, Ms. Strickland. I know you were court appointed. Thank you for accepting the appointment and discharging your responsibility ably. Thank you.